Welcome to episode 36. I hope you're all having a good June. It is the fifth day of June, so you've had 5 days to decide whether you like this month or not. But you're going to have only an hour to decide whether you like this episode or not. Did you like this episode? I loved it. Except it's, well, not happened yet. But we're going to get there. Starting with the top six, movies with a strong sense of place. That'll be pretty interesting, as will the trivia question to follow, and Stephen Keller's very own guide to focal lengths in our Film Buffs Dictionary segment. Following that, I'm going to keep talking about Disney animated features. We'll talk about the more recent Disney animated features up to the present day, and concluding things, okay, well, how are you going to survive a David Lynch movie if we don't tell you? I don't think your chances are very good. I'm Sam Stoddard.
And I'm Stephen Keller, speaking backwards, or not really, but trying to sound like the backwards characters in Twin Peaks. Was that pretty good?
Just, yeah.
That sounded like...
No follow-up on that. One of the great things movies can do for us is show us a lot of neat places. So this week's top six list is going to be the top six list of movies that have a strong and irreplaceable sense of place. What I mean, basically, is that you hear sometimes, oh, this place, this desert, this mountain, this whatever, is like another character in the film. And that's what we're looking for. And what we mean is that the place that the story is set or a scene is set in a movie is such an integral part of how it plays out, even affecting the story, possibly, but in any case, being such an integral part of the effect, the impact, the resonance that this movie has, that you could not imagine it being set elsewhere, really. So let's just jump right in, and I'm going to pick for my number six choice the 1972 film Sleuth, which is a mind game between these two characters engaged in a ruthless battle of wits, and it all takes place in this most lavish mansion I mean you could possibly imagine. It has so much character and elegance to it, inside and out. The grounds are gorgeous, too. It's just a wonderful playground for the story to unfold. I would not say the story itself is tied to the location. You could imagine this type of mind game between two characters, very introspective type of story. You can imagine that happening in other places, but it would definitely have had an entirely different impact somewhere else, because the mansion says a lot about the character who lives there and gives us important insight into the kind of life he lives. And there's a really interesting editing technique that's used here that has to do with the setting, and that's the fact that very often in the course of the film, the characters are talking, you know, and then the film will cut away from them to a close-up of something on the mantle or something on the table or a clock or a figurine, you know, some ritzy little item of decor, and then I'll cut back to the characters. It's a very strange thing, actually, but the film is always driving home the essence of where we are, and that, I think, is very important to the film's effect.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess I was thinking more broadly for most of mine than that.
I have a couple of broad ones, too, yeah.
Definitely an interesting choice. And I mean, obviously, certainly that specific set is integral to that story. Good pick. Well, my number six is kind of a personal one, and it's something we talked about just recently here on the show, and that's the 1993 film Shortcuts by Robert Altman. I found it strange. I actually only ended up with one period piece on my entire list, and this one, of course, is not a period piece, but at this point in time, it almost feels like one. It takes place in and around Los Angeles in 1993, and of course, as someone who grew up in Southern California and remembers 1993 in SoCal very vividly, I was amazed at how nostalgic this film made me feel, more so than anything else. And, you know, I thought of another movie, like, say, The Big Lebowski by the Coens, which is deliberately set in just about the same time period in pretty much the same location. And that one doesn't quite feel nearly as tied to its place and time as Shortcuts did. I mean, it amazes me just how well it captures the sense of Los Angeles, I guess. It's interesting because it's based on a series of short stories that take place in the Pacific Northwest, about as different of a location as you could imagine from the Los Angeles County and its surroundings. But
what about India?
I don't know. I think it's about a toss-up.
Okay.
Honestly, I think there are more people from India living in Los Angeles than there are pine trees, for instance. So, anyway, absolutely feels really, really tied to that type of place. I don't think that movie could work if you moved it to New York City, for instance. it'd have to be changed dramatically.
Well, that's interesting because at the time I had seen this movie, I hadn't even been to Southern California, and it still resonated with me. But, well, of course, all kinds of movies are shot there. But, yeah, I think you're right. It's very much tied to a certain type of cultural mentality, and I can see how, if that's what is around you growing up, that that's going to be very evocative. My number five choice is a Western, and actually it's a spaghetti Western. It's called A Fistful of Dollars from 1964. Sergio Leone's adaptation of the Dashiell Hammett novel, Red Harvest, actually. So if you think that film is a remake of Akira Kurosawa's Yojimbo, well, it kind of is, but that film was based on Red Harvest as well. Anyway, A Fistful of Dollars is pretty revolutionary for the Western, which was a mature genre at the time. The West was dirtier and more violent and more of a dystopian world. You think of the Old West in classical Hollywood was a place of hope and optimism and expansion and everything, and this kind of place, pretty much, you know, life and hope have left it. And the town it takes place in has this great southwestern architecture, but the buildings are all dingy and corroded, and the film actually feels pretty claustrophobic, which is weird for a Western on the wide open plains. But obviously this story can and has been done in very different types of settings. We mentioned Yojimbo, it takes place in Japan, and Red Harvest is, you know, the original novel is something else as well, and there's even a fantasy remake of it, say, in a fantasy world or something. But you get a very distinct feel here that is not replicated in the other versions, where the film is pretty firmly tied to this particular creepy, unsavory kind of place where bad guys are always lurking around the corner and you know, that kind of thing.
And I think it's interesting that the Sergio Leone's vision of the West, I think, has kind of come to be the vision of the West in modern Westerns. I mean, everything from the film Tombstone to the TV series Deadwood, the West is no longer a happy, optimistic place, but, you know, sort of an oppressive place that's ruled by gangsters and mob rule in the absence of any sort of civilizing forces. Interesting how powerful a sense of location it is, that it's just really become the norm for Westerns these days, I would argue. Well, my number five isn't a specific place exactly, but it's definitely a time period, and I would argue that it's indicative of the entire nation, and that's the film Network from 1976 by Sidney Lumet, a deeply cynical and biting satire on the media and its effect on society. I don't know that there's a 70s film out there that has more to say about the perception of the public and the way that we interface with people in power than this film, and certainly there were a lot of them that were on exactly this theme at that time, but of course, the amazing thing is, the one thing everyone says about Network is how it becomes increasingly prophetic seeming as time goes on, but I don't know, there's still something to me that says this is an absolute 1970s movie that absolutely takes place in America and is about American society. I don't know that, you know, this, you couldn't move this to any other time or place and have this story work. It's so tied to it. And all the performances and the story is just completely and totally centered around that particular society at that point in time.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you made that movie today, if it came out today, at the time when a lot of the things it was anticipating happening satirically really did start happening, then I think it would be a big so what. I mean, apart from the fantastic dialogue and acting and all that stuff, but as far as thematically, it would be a big so what. And in the 70s, very resonating, and yeah, it does still retain that power. My number four, a little less respectable, shall we say, but I like it a lot. It's a film by Guillermo del Toro, whose Pan's Labyrinth is getting a lot of favorable attention now, but it's from 1997, and it's called Mimic, and it's one of these giant creatures jumping out at people in the dark movies that Alien-inspired, I guess. In this case, it's giant mutated bugs that are eating people. You know, I really like this one. I think it's because it takes place in this wonderful setting, this underground, abandoned, broken-down subway station, so that all these old subway cars and tracks are all twisted and bent out of shape, and things hanging from the ceiling, and walls that have collapsed in, and vaulted ceilings. There's even a few windows at the top where you can see the people out on the street walking around, but they're, of course, down in the dark trapped with these mutant bugs, and they can't get out there even though they can see it. But great sense of location, and I think that's what redeems the movie from being just another schlock thing, genre horror monster movie kind of thing. It's just great visuals in this great place to work in.
I could have spent a million years thinking about this list, and I never would have predicted that anyone would ever pick Mimic.
Hey, it's a great sense of place.
I guess. I've pretty much forgotten everything about that movie since I watched it, but hey, if you liked it. My number four pick is something we've talked about on the show before, and that's Ikiru by Akira Kurosawa. And I thought of a couple different movies from post-war Japan that I could have picked, but this is just still my favorite, so I'm going to go with that. He gets the edge. I mean, it's about a guy just really struggling to find his place in this society after the war in Japan and trying to figure it out. And I think it, without ever really touching on the issue, I think it says a lot about what it would have been like to be a member, especially a male Japanese businessman at this point in time, trying to figure out where to go after the devastating loss of World War II and how badly it destroyed not just the Japanese economy, but in a lot of ways the Japanese way of life that they had known prior to World War II. I mean, they had a completely new government and sort of a huge infusion of Western values and ideals, and I think it caused a lot of friction and a sort of dystopian sense to that society for a time until it adjusted. And here's a movie about a guy struggling to live and to cope with all of that in that climate, and boy, does it really speak to us today. And I think that's sort of a theme on a lot of these movies, is that though they evoke a very specific sense of time and place, they're still strong stories, and they do such a good job of evoking that time and place that we empathize completely with the characters, and we understand that setting. It feels as though we're in it, and this one definitely does that.
Yeah, I think it's a great film, and I see what you say about it. I think we did interpret this topic pretty differently, though, but that's good, though, because then we have two different perspectives. My number three, however, I think might be more in line with what you're thinking. Maybe it's even your number one, and I'm going to steal it. But it's time for the obligatory Coen Brothers pick, and it's going to be, I guess, Fargo, because it really could have been any early Coen Brothers film. It's impossible to imagine, for example, Barton Fink anywhere but in that creepy hotel, or the Hudsucker Proxy anywhere but in a skyscraper, or indeed, you know, any Coen Brothers film somewhere where you can't have a big fat guy behind a desk smoking a cigar and being evil. But you definitely can't imagine Fargo anywhere but in the barren snowscapes of North Dakota. I mean, Fargo is so tied to its location that it's the title of the movie, although a lot of it takes place in Minnesota. But that area, anyway, contributes to the whole flavor of the film. It's all caught up in the accents and the attitudes and lifestyles of rural Minnesota and North Dakota. And, of course, those snowscapes are just absolutely critical of conveying the sense of isolation and, you know, the irony of the dark story in a bright place, all that kind of stuff is tied in with this place.
Yeah, I considered it. I also considered, I think, my other pick from the Coens, like I mentioned, would have been The Big Lebowski, just because it's, I mean, the Coens are great for the way they make period pieces that you wouldn't think of necessarily being period pieces. I think almost all their movies, oh, man, you could also pick Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? That would be a great
yeah,
pick,
most of them, I think.
Anyway, I don't have a Coen, so this is all you.
Wow.
Well, my number three pick is one of my favorite movies. I think I've picked it before for something else, and it's Lawrence of Arabia, the 1962 film by David Lean, where the vast Arabian deserts become sort of the central character in a way, because our protagonist is such a distant character to us that the deserts become what we most closely identify the film with. And you mentioned the vast snowscapes in Fargo. Well, they're, I think, outdone by the vast sandscapes of Lean's epic masterpiece. Here's a movie that you need to see on the big screen if you haven't, because it's just absolutely mind-blowing, the huge, vast emptiness and sense of loneliness and isolation, but also of beauty and wonder that you get from being out there, of seeing men reduced to specks in the distance against these gigantic, sweeping dunes, and such wonderful cinematography. I couldn't imagine it being anywhere else. And of course, it also takes place during World War I. Like I said, I only picked one period piece, and this was it. And I think the ending of the film, where it sort of deals very specifically with sort of the politics at the end of World War I, I really like it. I think it works well, though maybe a little different from what we usually think of when we think of this movie. But yeah, couldn't take place anywhere else.
Absolutely not. And this was on my short list, but I knew you'd pick it, so it missed. Great. I don't know of a more memorable desert in any movie than in Lawrence of Arabia. It's just used so well as a place for these events to happen. My number two is The Battle of Algiers from 1966, and it's a story about the a very bloody revolution that happened in Algiers between conflict between the French Foreign Legion and the Algerian guerrilla fighters. But it all takes place in this wonderfully depicted city. Very documentary-like, we use that term sometimes, but don't be mistaken. This is a very tense film, very suspenseful, very powerful, emotionally powerful. But I think a lot of the effect of the movie is how it takes place in just a wonderfully realized location. There's all these, first of all, the architecture, of course, is very exotic, unless you live in Algiers, in which case it's what you see out your window, but very exotic architecture, and the streets and the layout of the city plays an important role in the story, and also the buildings, and you have these broken down buildings in some cases, and other types of buildings, and all these nooks and crannies that people can hide in. You know, you go up to the top of a building to defend it, and there's a siege laid to it. There's all these different uses of locations that I think is very specific to this particular city and type of architecture, and certainly the cultural aspect of what it's like in this place as well. Very great use of a location here.
Yeah, absolute great pick. And my number two film is sort of also a documentary kind of style. I had to pick an Italian neorealist film, and the only question was which one I was going to do. I could have filled it with neorealist films if I really wanted to, but I just picked my favorite, and that's Rome, Open City from 1945 by Roberto Rossellini, which is about the German occupation of Italy, and it's sort of its final days of World War II. And here's one of the movies that really spawned the neorealist movement, and it's a movement that, of course, as we talked about previously, way back early on in the show, is all about capturing the here and the now and trying to do it in a realistic sense. And so it's really filmed just as World War II is closing, using pretty much all real locations and lots of actors who are not really professionally trained actors, and boy, does it seem like a very realistic depiction of life, because in many ways it is a depiction of real life, and I think that's what makes it such a powerful, intriguing film. And one of my favorite things about it is just, as someone who's interested in history, how much of a historical document this is. It's great being able to see all these locations actually in 1945 with people who really have just gone through this. It's amazing to see sort of fiction and fact blended like this.
Yeah, there's something evocative about a war-torn city when you see something, because it's not normally what we see. And war, of course, affects a lot of people in different ways. There's a lot of loss and death, and then afterward you have the rebuilding and the hope of something better. And so if you see just a city razed, and these buildings blown apart, barely still standing and everything, everywhere you look, all around you, and then you see the people living in that environment and dealing with those consequences, that's really powerful. And yeah, I'm so glad you picked a neorealist film. I thought about a bunch of them and I couldn't really decide on one, and I ended up kind of not picking one, but I really wanted to, and I'm glad you did. I had to make room for Mimic, you see. But anyway, way back in episode 2, we did talk about Italian neorealism, and I think you mentioned that, you know, if you didn't have a lot of money to build sets, well, you just go outside and film something that's around you, where you're living. And I think that's part of the power of these neorealist films, is this is real. This is what the filmmakers even were living in at the time. My number one choice is also of a war-torn city, but used in an entirely different way.
I'll bet we have the same movie.
Did we do it again?
I think so.
Okay, well, take it away.
No, go ahead.
Last time we both picked this movie for number one, I had it first, so you should present it.
No, go ahead.
Is it 1, 2, 3?
No, actually, it's not.
Oh, okay. Well, perfect.
Interesting.
Huh. Yes, no, I almost didn't want to pick this because we've talked about it before a number of times, but 1, 2, 3 from 1961, the Billy Wilder comedy about Coca-Cola and the Cold War, and madcap car chases between the Russians and the Americans through Berlin, divided Berlin back and forth across the different sectors, and you see in the backgrounds, you see all the war-torn buildings and everything blown apart and all that. Berlin, especially at this time, 1961, this was right as the Berlin Wall was going up. They almost couldn't complete filming because of that. This was such an evocative place. I really wish I could have been there at the time, because I don't know of a more unique place on the planet in recent history, in fact. You got a city that's divided, that's just blasted by war, not particularly rebuilt, at least in certain sectors, and yeah, divided. Different country gets its own piece of this city, and what a thing. But then you set this comedy in it, this really madcap thing, very fast-paced comedy, and has a lot to say about the Cold War and about the division of Berlin, even though it's really about people falling over and saying fast, funny lines and things like that. So I don't want to convey the impression that this is a very heavy movie, but it definitely couldn't have taken place anywhere else. I mean, where else are you going to get this rich interaction of conflicting cultures and be able to satirize that?
Wow, half the stuff you said could apply to my number one film, even though it's not yours. And it is a movie that we spotlighted, though. It's The Third Man from 1949 by Carol Reed. Also a movie about a city that's being rebuilt from World War II, and also that happens to be divided up into a bunch of different locations. And also a movie in which you get to see rubble and every other, apparently. I mean, it makes it seem like Vienna after World War II was just more destroyed than it was built, and I guess probably that was the case. And so you get the odd contrast of a city that has modern architecture and, of course, glorious old architecture, and just piles of rubble that have yet to be cleaned up or rebuilt. And it's a movie that absolutely uses the architecture of the city, that absolutely uses the way the city is organized and run by these different forces and these different groups that can't speak the same language and fight into quadrants and sewer system that runs underneath, and so many strange, interesting location. I remember at the time we did the spotlight, we almost compared it to a science fiction movie where they have to build up the location and then deal with it, and certainly that's what happens here. But I guess you could make some comparisons to the divided Berlin of 1, 2, 3. The two movies themselves, I don't think, could be much further apart in terms of tone.
Yeah, not really.
Both great picks, absolutely.
Okay, well, let's recap this strangely divergent set of lists that we have here. My number six is Sleuth from 1972 that takes place in a wonderfully detailed mansion. Number five, A Fistful of Dollars from 1964 that reinvents the Old West, is not a very great place. Mimic is my number four choice from 1997, which sets a lot of otherwise uninteresting action in this great underground broken-down subway station. Number three is Fargo from 1996, a story you couldn't really tell well anywhere but in the snowscapes and the culture of Minnesota and North Dakota. Number two, The Battle of Algiers, which coincidentally takes place in Algiers, from 1966. And number one, 1, 2, 3 from 1961 in a divided Berlin.
And my top six movies that evoke a specific time and place are number six, Shortcuts from 1993 by Robert Altman. Number five, Network, the 1976 film by Sidney Lumet. Number four, Akira Kurosawa's 1952 classic Ikiru. Number three, The Great, Great Lawrence of Arabia from 1962 by David Lean. Number two, the Italian neorealist classic Rome, Open City by Roberto Rossellini, made in 1945, just as World War II was drawing to a close. And number one, The Third Man, Carol Reed's great 1949 film.
Got kind of a strange trivia question for you this time. It's about a Best Picture Oscar winner. Oscar season's over, but hey, what the heck. Fair game for trivia questions. The question is, what is the first Best Picture Oscar winner to refer to a previous Best Picture Oscar winner?
Wait, what?
Yeah, it would be like in the movie, they talk about another movie. And so in a Best Picture winner, they talk about a previous film that also won Best Picture.
Okay, I got you.
And actually, not only do they talk about one, they talk about two in a way. One is very explicit, though. One's kind of an oblique reference. Let's get back to it at the end of the show, and we'll tell you the answer.
Okay, we're continuing our discussion of all things relating to cinematography. I'm not going to try and pronounce that other word. We're going to talk this week about focal lengths. This is a term related to lenses, and we've kind of touched on it in the past, not quite exactly covering it, but it's definitely important, and you probably know something about it, even if you don't recognize the term itself. So let's sort of start off with a technical definition, and it's the distance between the what's called the rear nodal point on the lens. And the nodal point is basically the real point on a lens where all the light gets sort of focused down into a single kind of field. So you've got all these different light beams, and they enter the lens, and at some point, right at the very back of the lens, they all get converged to go to the actual thing that's going to capture it, you know, the film. So you think of a lens, it's, you know, it exists out in this kind of tube or something, and then somewhere behind the lens sits the camera shutter, which opens and closes and gets wider and that kind of stuff. And so, you know, on a movie camera, generally speaking, the shutter is opening and closing 24 times a second. So you have the lens, and it sits in front of the shutter, and behind the shutter is the film. Basically, the focal length is the distance between the lens and the film. The film is called the focal plane, basically. It's where all the light is being focused onto. So while the lens is at maximum focus, this very rear point of the lens to the focal plane, the film itself. So the larger the focal length, the longer the lens is, because as the focal length increases, obviously that means the distance between the lens and the film is increasing. And what this lets you do is a couple different things. First and foremost, it lets you magnify things, because the greater the focal length, the more magnified an image is. This just has to do with the way it's able to capture light, and so you have these really long lenses. That's where you'll hear the term come from, a long lens, because literally a long lens is long. It's physically long because we have to separate the lens from the film further. And if you've seen movie cameras, oftentimes you have these long lenses. If you've seen standard film cameras, say if you're at a sporting event and you see a photographer down on the sidelines of a football game taking pictures, well, they're using these really long lenses. You know, they look comically large. In fact, sometimes they can be really large to the point where, you know, the photographer's got like a little rod coming out of the midpoint of the lens so he can hold it steady, that kind of stuff. Because those let you magnify things, and, you know, conversely, the shorter the lens, the less magnified. And sort of right along with this is a shorter lens has a greater angle of view. And the angle of view is essentially how much information you can capture, the total angle that you can see. So a wide-angle lens lets you see a whole lot of stuff. It's very, well, a wide angle. So we see another term coming up, we can kind of get where it comes from. So a shorter lens is also a wider lens. A longer lens is a narrower lens. The short lens has a very wide angle of view, and as the focal length of the lens increases, your angle of view decreases. So you have things that are magnified, but you can't fit as many things in the frame at once. And that kind of makes sense, of course. You know, if you're magnifying things, obviously they're going to be bigger on the film. You can kind of illustrate focal length to yourself. If you take your finger and you hold it up to your eye, maybe you close one eye, and you make a circle with your index finger and your thumb, and you hold it up right all the way up to your eye that you have open, and you can see that you can see lots of stuff through that finger, right? Because you pretty much have the same angle of view that you would have if you didn't have anything there, if you put it right up to your eye. Now start moving that circle away from you, right? That's increasing the focal length. You can think of your fingers in a circle as the lens itself, and as you move it further and further away from you, the amount of stuff you can see through that circle gets smaller and smaller. It's the same sort of thing here with focal length. So the consequence of this is, if you want to use a really long lens because you really want to magnify a distant object, well, what happens is you get fewer things in the frame at once. Now, of course, you know, it tends to be that as you're further away, you still get lots of stuff, but just keep that in mind. Now, a zoom lens, we talked about zooms before, I think we may have mentioned this before, a zoom lens is a lens where the focal length can be altered on the fly. So we can go from a wider or shorter lens to the longer or narrower lens, letting us change our magnification and zoom in on something. So that's why when you're zoomed in, well, zoomed in means that the focal length has increased, it's longer, so now things are more magnified, and also lets you highlight something. We talked about that function of the zoom before in our entry for the zoom. Remember we said a zoom is kind of like the old pinhole shot or the iris shot where you focus in on a single object. Well, the zoom does that because as the focal length of the zoom lens increases, the angle of view decreases, meaning that you just focus on that one thing. Now, some downsides of a longer lens. You have less of what's called the depth of field. And this is something we talked about. Remember we did the spotlight on Stanley Kubrick, and we talked about the effects of using a super long lens when Kubrick filmed Barry Lyndon for all the outdoor portrait shots where they're supposed to look like old paintings. All those shots were filmed from really far away with really long lenses, and that decreased the depth of field, making everything look really, really flat. So that's essentially a consequence of using a larger focal length. You get that extra magnification, but you also have less angle of view and less depth of field.
Well, last week we talked about the Disney animated features up through the early 80s, and of course, as a lot of people know, The Little Mermaid in 1989 really kicks off a third golden age. But I want to backtrack just a little bit because we got to talk about The Black Cauldron in 1985, and this is a flop in the theaters. It's a very big financial disappointment, but it is an interesting movie to talk about. First of all, it's the first Disney animated feature to be rated PG for being a bit scary. As we said last week, the Disney animation was not in a great state throughout the 70s, and so, you know, they were trying to think of ideas on how can we recapture audiences to our animated films, and one of the ideas was to try to appeal to teenagers, maybe, a little bit older, young teenagers, maybe. So The Black Cauldron is going to be scary, it's going to be rated PG, it's going to be pretty dark. I mean, you got these zombie-like creatures running around and killing people, and it was going to be even darker than it is. Jeffrey Katzenberg, who's the new Disney chairman at the time, now he's at DreamWorks, but he had a number of cuts made just prior to the theatrical release that showed things like, you know, decapitations and just these zombies slicing through these people. and you can tell where the cuts are because there's a jump in the soundtrack. The cuts were made just too late in the game to fix things like that. So we have this big budget dark fantasy. Even after those cuts, it's still a pretty scary movie, attempting to reach an older audience than previous animated features have been targeted to. And this is be the second 70mm movie that Disney would make. And it's they only ever made two, Sleeping Beauty and The Black Cauldron. So 70mm. We've got a number of other technological firsts kind of things going, such as this is the first Disney animated feature to use computer-generated imagery. And in a very strange way, too, because the shapes were manipulated on computers and then printed to cells for the animators to work on by hand again, rather than just leaving the images in the computer to color there. So, anyway, big expensive gamble. Very expensive, and it failed. I mean, it lost tons of money at the box office. Unfortunately, I think things would have been quite different if it had made money. But the consequence were we returned to these lighter fairy tale type of movies for the future. And the Disney company itself practically disowned the movie. I mean, it wasn't merchandised. It was 15 years before it hit home video. It was unavailable for a very long time. I remember being so excited when it finally came out and I could see it again because I had seen it in the theaters the once and was never able to see it again. Still not being released that often, actually. But in the meantime, it's kind of a cult classic. A lot of people have discovered in recent times, perhaps partly because of its scarcity. Sometimes when you restrict access to a movie, it becomes more, you know, the mystique really grows in people's minds. But it is a real break with the Disney formula that is quite interesting. Very exciting kind of adventure movie. First one where there aren't any songs, for example, is another thing. All the Disney animated films to date had been musicals. I actually would love it if Disney would re-release it before the Katzenberg cuts were made. I mean, it's not that gory. It would still just be a PG movie. But, you know, I think there'd be a market for that because there's a lot of people who are teenagers and 20-somethings now or 30s like me that grew up with this movie in a way and just were kind of denied access to it. Following that, we get The Great Mouse Detective in 86, a sort of a takeoff of Sherlock Holmes. It's decent enough. Oliver and Company in 1988, takeoff on Oliver Twist. It's decent enough too, I guess. But in 1989, we get The Little Mermaid, and that's really the beginning of the new Disney. Paradoxically, because in many ways this is a return to form. We got a fairy tale adaptation, the first since Sleeping Beauty, 30 years before that. Terrific movie, though, probably because of the songs. Best songs, I think, of any Disney movie. And it's something that really the whole family can enjoy. It's not just kids, it's not just teenagers or boys or girls. Sebastian the Crab, great character. I remember when I saw this the first time, and you know, there's that Under the Sea song that I think eventually won the Oscar. It was just great. It was just so exciting and lively and everything. And so after that, the whole rest of the movie, as I was watching it, I'm like, I hope there's just one more Sebastian song. And of course, the movie does give you that, although it's a very different type of song, a bit more subtle, but just as good, I think. And that song was nominated, by the way. Both songs were nominated for an Academy Award, but Under the Sea won it.
Yeah, and fortunately, that's actually one of those rare times where the Academy gave the Oscar to a song that didn't suck. So I'm glad they got it right.
Yes, they did.
It's actually a really good song.
Okay, well, the Little Mermaid success. I mean, I think right here we got an explosion of Disney activity in the animation scene. The animation department went from 300 employees to about, 2,400 throughout the 1990s, which also had a number of other successful releases, a bunch of them. I mean, let me just run through. The Rescuers Down Under, which wasn't a success, but I'll talk about that in a minute. Then we got Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, The Lion King, Pocahontas, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, Hercules, Mulan, and Tarzan. I mean, most of these, pretty much all of them except The Rescuers Down Under, were smash hits. And most interesting, actually, I think, is that they were almost all musicals at a time when musicals just were not being made. It's not like we get a lot now, but we do get one or two every year now, ever since Moulin Rouge or so. But nobody was making musicals in the 90s except for Disney with animation, and it wasn't just quiet kind of musicals. It was these big Broadway-style production numbers, and I think that kind of filled the gap there. We have no musicals anymore. Well, here comes these animated movies with these really great production numbers in them, and so I think that appealed to people as well. As I said, The Rescuers Down Under, this is kind of a holdover from the earlier era. I'm sure it was begun before The Little Mermaid was a big hit, and actually it was made initially as direct-to-video and initially as an experiment with a new system for computerizing the animation process called CAPS. And so that's mainly the reason that's there. I actually like it quite a bit. But Beauty and the Beast is the real standout from this group in the 90s. Just about the perfect working of the Disney formula, if you want to call it that. The first film ever, and probably the only one that they'll ever be, to be nominated for Best Picture, an animated movie nominated for Best Picture. Because now we have the animated feature category, and probably that means we won't get any more animated features nominated for the big one, but yeah, the only one ever.
That's surprising still, I mean.
Yeah, it is. It's not something you necessarily expect would compete with the usual type of movies that tend to get nominated. I remember when I saw this, I was in college, and with a bunch of people packed into a theater, all the other college kids, and I remember just being just fascinated beyond belief. I majored in computer science, so computer kind of stuff was an interest to me. Animation was, obviously. And there's that ballroom scene, which was quite famous at the time, at least. Maybe it still is, I don't know. But there's a shot where the camera just kind of, they're dancing in the ballroom, and then it zooms up at the chandelier. And as the camera does that, you get a real sense of a three-dimensional chandelier with all these different crystals draped around, just hundreds of crystals. As the camera angle changes, they all move in a very compelling, convincingly 3D way. And that's not something you really ever saw in animation before. It was all done by hand or, not with the computerized tools that they have. So this was a real spectacle, and it's just one quick shot. But it made a real big impact. It's like the first time you saw, I don't know, pick a special effects movie that really made an impression on you, whether it's Jurassic Park or Forrest Gump with the inserting Tom Hanks and all the different things. This was one of those moments for me. And then it became sort of an expectation. The next one would have Aladdin's carpet ride through the underground volcano kind of thing. That had a real three-dimensional action sense to it. And then the wildebeest stampede in The Lion King. There was always going to be that one scene that would be really visually dazzling. That was kind of interesting. But yeah, Aladdin, then the Lion King and Pocahontas. And what you notice if you look at this progression through the 90s, though, is we're kind of going to phase out the music. I don't know why. It was just a huge success for them. And as the 90s went on, the box office returns kind of dwindled. They were still big hits at the end, but not as much as the big musicals were. And we're also going to see more of a contemporary sense of humor and lingo in it. I remember in Aladdin, you got, first of all, you got the genie, which is just Robin Williams going nuts, but you got Iago, the parrot, saying things like, not, which was the kind of slang that came about at that time. It was just kind of jarring to see something that wasn't timeless, that actually might get dated in time, starting to creep into these movies. And in 94, The Lion King makes more money than you could imagine. Highest theater average gross in history. That's any movie, even to date. highest grossing traditionally animated film in history. I mean, people loved it. There's great music. It had a Shakespearean kind of story to it, some contemporary comedy, and it just kind of blended well. I actually didn't like it as much as some of the earlier ones, but yeah, it's a great movie. A nice mix of different things. My three favorites, though, from the 90s, I mean, Beauty and the Beast that I talked about, and two others that I think are unfairly overlooked. One is The Hunchback of Notre Dame, which is a surprisingly emotionally powerful take on that story. You wouldn't think that would be a natural thing to animate. It's kind of funny. A lot of successful musicals and a lot of successful animated movies are made from unintuitive subjects. I mean, you got Anastasia. Why would that be a children's animated movie? That was from not Disney, but and then you got Tarzan, which is a really surprisingly wonderful take on the Burroughs character, certainly treated in the movies many times, but I think this is one of the stronger takes on that. And that, by the way, was the last really huge hit for Disney animation. In a way, I think they were too successful. Because what it did was it tempted all these other studios to start up their own animation houses and put some real money into them. So before that, decade after decade, I mean, there was this sense that only Disney can do this. And to try to replicate what Disney was doing was too big of a risk. Some people tried, there are some others in there, but for the most part, it was Disney's game. But when you make as much money as The Lion King did, it offsets the risk a little bit. So you get these other studios, especially DreamWorks. We think of DreamWorks today as being a pretty major animation studio with things like Shrek and I don't know what else. But before that, they got into the 2D animated game with some things like The Prince of Egypt and some other movies. Other studios are just piling in the game in the late 90s. And Disney, very weirdly, as I say, abandons the musical format and goes to these comedies, things like The Emperor's New Groove, action movies like Atlantis, and Lilo and Stitch. That was probably the biggest success of the 2000s movies so far. Treasure Planet, Brother Bear, Home on the Range. Just a list of movies that maybe you enjoy them while you're watching them, but not really what you can imagine will be cherished for generations. Fantasia 2000 is kind of stuck in there as kind of a different one. That's actually quite good, but I don't know. I think we're at the end now of Disney's third golden age, and hopefully there'll be a fourth, but at the moment what's happening is that they bought Pixar. Well, first of all, Disney abandoned this 2D animated thing and tried to get in on the 3D thing, and that for the first time makes Disney chasing a fad rather than forging the new territory, because Pixar started out really at the forefront of this with Toy Story and then A Bug's Life and then a number of other hits. And then Disney bought Pixar, but Pixar, that unit, is going to kind of still function as its own thing, and the bosses at Pixar are going to be also overseeing the main Disney unit, which so far has turned out in the world of 3D. It's done Chicken Little, and now it's got Meet the Robinsons in theaters. I don't know. I just can't see that competing with Pixar in a creative kind of a way, so I don't know what's going to happen to Disney animation in the future. But the historical reality is that Disney produced 44 traditionally animated features over a 67-year period, during which time, most of that time, it was the only game in town. And most of those movies are still watched by people who, you know, whose parents weren't even alive, possibly whose grandparents were not even alive when they were first made. I mean, that's just unheard of. Absolutely incredible for a single studio to be so dominant for so long. And that, I think, leads to a lot of backlash sometimes. Some people don't like too much success. So it's fashionable to knock on Disney, but you just can't argue with that kind of accomplishment, I don't think. Now that they're not riding high so as much anymore, it's kind of maybe less fashionable to knock on Disney. It still is, but there isn't the passion as much, I don't see, compared to 10 years ago. But yeah, the really amazing thing here is that most of these are still fresh. And, you know, people that call Groundhog Day an old movie will still fire up Lady and the Tramp and not really register the age of the thing. I mean, that's a pretty incredible achievement.
Sam?
Yes?
Sometimes I think that the gum I like will eventually come back in style, but I also worry that it just won't come to pass. And what if Dick Laurent is already dead? What am I going to do?
I think you got to talk to the Blue Cowboy about that.
But if I see him a second time... Anyway, Surviving a David Lynch movie is a ridiculous thing to do. Surviving a David Lynch movie is a ridiculously difficult thing to do. Surviving a David Lynch movie, a ridiculous thing to do. Between backwards talking dwarfs and hat and assassins and hitmen and gangsters and hitmen and people who aren't who they appear to be and evil people from other dimensions. Oh, geez, it's just so difficult. But I have a little bit of experience with it. I think you know something about this as well. Isn't that correct, Sam?
I have lived through too many David Lynch movies, I'm afraid.
Ooh. Well, maybe we can help each other out and help out our audience while we're at it. I think really the first tip to realize if you find yourself in a David Lynch movie is that nothing is what it seems. Everything has at least two meanings. In fact, everything has at least two meanings. This kind of comes down to don't trust people who seem helpful, and if people don't seem helpful, maybe they are. And also, particularly, to avoid small towns because they seem so nice. But, of course, if they seem nice, then underneath there's a hidden underbelly of crime and moral decay that's going to get you sucked into it. They do, however, make damn fine coffee and good pie, but I would still stay away from small towns. And just remember that things are not what they seem.
Yeah, and the other thing to remember is that everything has at least two meanings. Would you say that at least?
Right, at least.
Like, it might have 3 or 10 and maybe 100, but not one.
No, not one.
Not one, because that's not at least two. I have a piece of advice. Don't worry about going to jail. Going to jail is nothing to worry about. They always sneak in a replacement in the middle of the night, so it's just the way things work in a jail. And the other thing is, at some point, there's probably going to be an intruder in your house. You know, there are a few different ways you can deal with this. It's not quite the big deal you might think it is. If you live outside of a David Lynch movie, it's more of a situation. You got a lot of choices. Splatter the guy with blue paint. That usually works. You want to try something a little more subtle? Capture the guy, drive him out to a burning windmill, and demand that he hire your sister for a job. I mean, that would freak him out. If you can come up with something that involves a very short gunman, that would be ideal. Practical jokes are the best. Pretend it's you that's breaking into his house and apologize. Plead with him not to call the cops. You know, you can have fun. You don't just have to survive a David Lynch movie. You just have some laughs.
Well, what if someone's breaking into your house at the moment, but you start receiving mysterious videotapes that show someone is inside your house at night, filming what you're doing while you're asleep? How should you handle that? Is that even the same situation?
I think in that situation, you need to be careful that the person videotaping yourself is not actually you.
Okay, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mentioned earlier that nothing is what it seems. But we should also note that lots of times things are what they seem. For instance, Los Angeles. It seems glitzy and glamorous. Well, you know what? It is. But it also kind of seems morally bankrupt. LA has a real image as being a place of some kind of moral corruption. Well, guess what? It's also that as well. So avoid LA. Because, you know, you would think, applying the logic of nothing is what it seems, that LA would be a cool place to hang out, full of nice, down-to-earth people. It's not. It's full of people who sit behind ridiculously large desks pulling strings and talking into oddly colored telephones, who have nothing better to do with their time than to create some sort of conspiracy involving you. And they're going to frame you, and unless you can change into another person, you're going to get pinned for something you didn't do, unless you actually did do it, which you may have.
Yeah. And another thing I would suggest, though, is don't ever get into a car.
Oh, yes.
Stay away from cars. If you go out on the road, you're gonna have a run-in with angry gangsters. It's just guaranteed. Most likely you get pulled over by a big-shot gangster that thinks you owe him money, and uncomfortable words will be exchanged, and you'll try to convince him he's mistaking you for somebody else. But before you know it, it'll turn out that you are somebody else. You just don't need that kind of hassle. So stay away from cars. If you have to get in a car and go somewhere, do not drive at night, and do not drive off the highway. Stay on the highway during the daytime, rush hour or something. It's not necessarily safe, but it's the safest you're going to get out there on the road if you have to get somewhere, such as away from Los Angeles.
Yeah. The big problem with cars and road trips in general is that they're likely to take you through small towns.
Yeah.
And that's just bad news.
Don't stop for gas.
Though you should note that if you want to travel, the one safe mode of traveling, ride a lawnmower over long distance. That will keep you safe.
You got a point.
Yeah, I know. Don't get the car. Fire up the old lawnmower and take a cross-country trip. It'll actually be quite G-rated, I think, if But you mentioned gangsters getting pulled over by gangsters. There's no good way to deal with gangsters in a David Lynch movie. I would just say close your eyes and hope for the best. That's my tip for gangsters. I don't think there's any real easy way to handle them.
I think there's a way to avoid gangsters, though. It's kind of...
Does it involve a rider lawnmower?
Well, that is one way. That's a good way, because, you know, it's funny, I always find that nothing strange happens when you're on a rider lawnmower. It's just like...
Nothing at all, really. Just a lot of... you see a lot of wheat?
Yeah.
That's about it.
There's the world where scary things happen, but you just curl up on your rider lawnmower and you're safe from it all. That's a good one. But no, I think with gangsters, the trick is not to be a person that is picked on by gangsters. Because it's a very interesting thing. If you're trying to survive an action movie or any other kind of movie, you pretty much need to be the hero. And you do not want to be the hero in a David Lynch movie, you'll probably survive, but you're going to go through living hell to do it. The thing is, if you are not the hero, if you're actually maybe the gangster, or at least somebody takes on that kind of role, you're going to be okay. You're not going to get any comeuppance or anything. The best part is you don't have to actually be bad. I mean, you certainly can be if you want. You can go around terrorizing people in all sorts of terrible ways. But you can be a bad guy just by looking the part and sneering a lot. Most important of all to do this, have a commanding authority about you and never lose it. Because if you don't have authority over the other characters around you, they will use theirs to bully you around. And then I don't think there's a way to turn it around after that point. So you have to start out. If you act like a victim, you will be the victim. So be confident, in charge. If a guy starts sneering at you, be unflinching and tell him that the white-hatted man will be very displeased with him. Mm. And things will work out for you after that.
Also, I think another key to being a gangster is to develop some sort of strange personality quirk, be it, you know, drinking from ridiculously small cups of cappuccino or taking hits from a helium tank. Anything like that will make you, I think, a little more commanding. All real gangsters act like that. Now, this is one I'm not really sure of, but I would say generally, as a rule, it's good to avoid becoming other people. It's really tiring and stressful on you. You know, and what if you happen to switch into somebody who's killed somebody else, or you switch into a person who's actually the dream of somebody else? That's bad news. The one thing, you know, you mentioned before, going to jail, I think maybe it's useful to switch into another person if you get thrown into jail, because then that's a good way to get out, obviously. But generally speaking, I think switching into other people is a bad idea. What do you think?
I think you got it right. It is just sort of a stressful thing. You can survive it just fine, but, you know, why bother? There's so much fun you can have in a David Lynch movie because, like, here's an example. Let's say that there's somebody around you who's kind of annoying and you just don't want that person to be around anymore. Ordinarily, you'd maybe have to make up an excuse or, you know, get involved in some kind of difficult social situation to manipulate. In a David Lynch movie, you pretend he's not there anymore and you just go about doing household chores or something as if you're alone, and before you know it, you will be. Don't carry on the charade too long, though, because that's also how you get somebody to reappear again. You know, if he's not there, pretend that he's not there, and he'll show up. So, you can have a lot of fun manipulating reality.
Yeah, true. You know who's not fun, though? Laura Dern. Stay the hell away from her. She's just trouble, period. She herself may not be trouble, but she'll get you into trouble somehow. I would always stay away from Laura Dern whenever I'm in a David Lynch movie.
I think she's in trouble.
Exactly. Stay away from that. You don't want to save anybody, because then, you know, you're likely to just get wound up in something bad, and you end up on a road trip trying to save her, and then it's the Wizard of Oz all over again, and you don't want that.
Right. Yeah.
What I think my final piece of advice may be the most important, which is to look for omens at all times. Listen to mysterious strangers, especially if they appear in your dreams. Even when they're talking backwards, they give you great information that can be and will be useful. They don't tend to lie to you. They tend to tell you exactly what's going on, though they'll tell it to you cryptically. It's especially true, again, if they're in a dream, and even more true if they happen to be either a dwarf or a cowboy. Definitely do what they tell you to. Try and take their advice as closely as you can. Just try and occasionally there will be the evil person who appears in a dream or something like that. So if it happens to be your evil doppelganger, I would definitely probably not listen to him, but maybe he's trying to trick you, so maybe you would listen to him. Anyway, I mean, that's important. But I think really the most important thing to do is to stay away from small towns, cities, and also isolated areas. I'm not sure how many places that leaves you to be.
On a tractor.
But if you can find a place that's not any of those, that might be a good fit. The suburbs, probably not a good place either. Yeah, I'll get back to you on that one.
The thing is, though, if you're in a small town, how do you know you're really not over there?
Ooh, that is problematic. I mean, because who knows if you're really where you are?
Not me.
I do. I did once, but I forgot. I did once, but I forgot.
It's the end of the show. Time to wrap up our trivia question before we wrap up the episode. And the question was, what is the first Best Picture Oscar winner to have a reference in it to a previous Best Picture Oscar winner? And actually, there's a reference to two different ones. What do you think it is, Steven? Do you have any idea? I'll tell you one thing. It's a movie that you love.
Oh, man. Can you give me a hint as to the movie that's referenced?
Yeah, Grand Hotel. It's Grand Hotel from 1932. I don't think that really helps you, but unless you remember the specific scene. I'll tell you the other one. There's a character who's talking about these other characters having a lost weekend, and that's the more oblique reference referring to The Lost Weekend, which also won Best Picture in 1945, so, you know, it comes after that.
Interesting.
But that one actually has a very close tie to the movie we're talking about now.
I don't know. I'm stumped. I'm really interested to hear the answer.
A very close tie. You know, who made Lost Weekend?
Lost Weekend, Billy Wilder.
Yeah, keep thinking Billy Wilder. Movies you love.
Billy Wilder.
One Best Picture.
Is it The Apartment?
Yes, it is The Apartment, yeah.
Oh, I don't remember the scene about Grand Hotel.
Fred McMurray, the character, was talking about the other two, talking about having a lost weekend. That's kind of an in-joke. But specifically, the Jack Lemmon character is trying to watch Grand Hotel on television, and there's just too many commercials or something like that. Yeah, so kind of an interesting question there. That's it for episode 36. Come to our website, though, allmovietalk.com. You might not have heard us say so before, but we actually have other movie content there at the website that doesn't make it into the podcast. That's kind of weird, but check it out. And also check out rankworks.com, RANKworks.com, a bunch of movie-related things, also a lot of other stuff there, too. And so what do we got next week? I think we got another episode in next week, right?
We do indeed, and we're going to be talking all about the Pixar animated features. Do a series spotlight on that, which is a lot of fun, because I know we both love Pixar. Our top six list, for people who like to play along and create their top six lists in advance, is going to be in the same light of our Movie Moms list for Mother's Day. Well, you guessed it, top six Movie Dads in honor of Father's Day. So check back next week on June 12th, when we'll have another episode.
You know, someday that cut, you say, is going to come back in style.